Mark Collier, Fort Thomas Matters Radio. What would it be like to live on food stamps? That's a question we're going to ask Northern Kentucky University economist Janet Hara today on today's show. Sponsored today, Omega Processing Solutions. The worst has happened. As a small business owner, your business has experienced a data breach. Now what? Well, if you're a customer of Omega Processing Solutions, they've got your back. They have a data protection program that's built into their services, things like data incident forensic services. They have a full forensic investigation team at your disposal. They also have legal services and a lot of different comprehensive things that you're going to need if there is a data breach. Worst case scenario, they've got your back. OmegaP.com. So today on the show, we have Janet Hara. She is the Senior Director for, let me get this right, Center for Economic Analysis and Development. We're going to refer to that as CEAD going forward. Janet is at NKU and just is in the midst of a year-long study to test what it's like to be on food stamps. Janet, how are you?
Good. It's good to be here.
Tell me what CEAD is briefly. It's an economic indicator for our region. You do a lot of different studies, issues, looking at the community's current and future economic well-being. Is that what CEAD does?
Yes, CEAD is we're part of the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business at NKU. We do applied economic research, and we are looking at what is driving our economy, both in Northern Kentucky and the rest of the Commonwealth.
And you used to have a blog. I loved on Fort Thomas Matters because it was titled Economic Matters. You can find some of those archives on Cincinnati.com. You've ceased, stop writing for them. But I'm going to throw this out there now. You've always got an invitation to write for Fort Thomas Matters whenever you want.
Well, thank you.
So let's talk about what you're doing right now. So you're not actually receiving food stamp benefits right now, or SNAP benefits as they used to be called, but you've actually adjusted your lifestyle and your budget for a family of four on food stamps. So why do this?
Well, first of all, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, every month they set what the budget is for a family of, based upon the number of people in your family and how old they are, et cetera. And they set a monthly budget for people receiving food stamps, or what are now formally known as SNAP benefits. For our family of four, it's about $650 a month. In my job, I get asked a lot of questions about public policy around poverty issues. And one of them I often get is, do we think we're paying enough for food stamps?
Sure.
And my response is, well, I don't really know. I've never really tried to live on it. And I thought to myself, well, you know, your mom's always telling you to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes before you make a judgment. So I thought, well, this is something I actually could do and try. So I talked with my husband, and we made the decision to try and do this for a year. We didn't tell the kids for the first 6 months. We thought, well, we'll just wait and see how it goes. And for the first 3 months, if it was really, really hard, we thought it was not going to be possible to feed them a healthy diet. We would just quietly go about our business and stop.
Sure. How old are your kids?
They're 11 and 13.
And you said you wanted to make the decision not to tell them until 6 months. And how long are you into the experiment now?
6 months. We started on January 1 of 2016.
Okay. So did they find out on their own? How did that go?
No. When we found out that the Inquirer was going to publish it, we decided we should probably tell them before somebody else did.
So, I mean, I think that speaks a lot right there, that maybe they didn't even realize that you were doing what you're doing.
Not really. The only thing is, my youngest, when I told her what we were doing, she immediately piped up, "That's why you haven't been buying potato chips."
So she misses the potato chips. What do you miss?
I miss the convenience. It really, it's very possible to eat a healthy diet and stay within budget, but it requires a lot more prep time. You can't buy the convenience foods. You can't run by the deli on your way home from work and, you know, pick up the rotisserie chicken and make something quick and easy.
Sure.
It takes a lot more actual cooking.
What are we talking about here on a day-to-day basis? Take me through what you're going to eat today, or what you've eaten so far, and then what you're going to eat for the rest of the day.
I think for lunch, we're having hamburgers on the grill. And then for dinner, we're having the typical chicken dinner, chicken and rice and green beans.
Your overall impressions are that, yes, right now, obviously the study is not complete, but at this moment, $650, which is what a family of four would typically get with variables considered, you think it's totally possible right now?
It is doable. Now, we have several advantages that not every person receiving SNAP benefits would have. Two big ones. Number one, we do not live in a food desert. I mean, we've got Kroger, Target, Walgreens, Aldi's, Fresh Time, all within a two-mile radius of our house. Plenty of food options.
Plus ways to get there.
And we have a reliable transportation to get there anytime we want. I can go to the grocery store. I can go every day if I want to. Many people on SNAP benefits do not have that option. They don't have public. They don't have reliable transportation. They have limited public transportation, and they live in a food desert. Now, we tend to think of those as being...
Yeah, let's describe what a food desert is for somebody that might not know.
We have many people in our communities that they live more than 2 to 3 miles from the nearest grocery store. And it's not just the urban core where we have neighborhoods like that. We have plenty in the urban core. But we also have a lot of our rural area. There are no grocery stores. And if you don't have reliable transportation and there's no nearby grocery store, then your default is to buy the cheap, convenient food that you can get at your convenience store, the gas station, or whatever happens to be near in your neighborhood.
Cheap and convenient. Those are the two words that I just heard. I think most people think about those two words interchangeably. When you start reviewing the actual numbers and looking at your receipts, are you finding a common theme or a common thread that is moving along the lines that you're buying cheap foods or convenient foods because they are cheap or convenient? Or is there a correlation there at all?
Well, actually, it depends on the kind of convenient food you're talking about. If you're talking about, if you want to get the frozen burrito, it's dirt cheap. Not much in the way of nutritional value. On the other hand, if you want convenient food like bagged lettuce, shredded carrots, rotisserie chicken, all of which are healthy food options,
sure.
There you are paying for the convenience. They are more expensive. I can buy a rotisserie chicken, and for that same amount of money, I can buy 3 times the amount of raw chicken and cook it myself.
How much time a day are you spending prepping the foods?
I spend probably about an hour and a half a day. I mean, we've really been prepping a lot. We make our own bread,
really?
Our own rolls.
Did you have to buy a bread machine to do that?
I had a bread machine.
Everybody's got a bread machine.
But they never use it.
Everybody's got one. It's always I think we got it as a Christmas gift one time. And yeah, everybody's got one, but now you're cranking them out, right?
I'm actually using that. That's very helpful, actually.
Yeah.
The other thing that is kind of, you wouldn't think about it, I wouldn't have thought about it in advance, but what's very helpful is having that crock pot.
Sure.
Because you have to buy cheap cuts of meat, put in that crock pot to make it taste like something.
Well, don't tell my wife that, because that's my secret and that's what I do, and she thinks that I'm a great cook, and really I don't know what I'm doing. I just throw it in there, and it's hard to screw it up.
That's right.
Who cooked in your house previously? Was it a group effort, kids help? Who pitched in?
My husband doesn't cook.
He doesn't cook.
No, I'm the cook.
Do kids cook at all?
They help some, but like most kids, they want to bake. They don't want to cook a meal.
Do you ever go out to eat anymore?
Oh, we have a budget. We go out once or twice a week. But I think there's a misconception that people on food stamps never go out to eat either. But all the data shows that's not true. Part of it's just lifestyle. I think people believe that most food stamp recipients don't work, and in fact, that's not the case at all. 75% of families on food stamps have one or two people working in the household. So sometimes, you know, when you're out working every day, eating out, sometimes you can't avoid it.
Well, I think probably pace of life, too, is something that, you know, maybe when somebody was on food stamps, whenever they started, New Deal or whatever, I think pace of life has really picked up too, to where an hour and a half a day prepping food and having to go through those extra steps to be able to make that $650 stretch a little bit for a family of four. I think that's an issue now that we're dealing with that maybe, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, we didn't have to deal with just because of the pace of the life that we live now. Has picked up significantly.
Well, it was interesting. People have asked me about that. And I thought to myself, well, how has that changed? But I think back, my grandmothers, neither of whom ever worked outside of the home, they thought nothing of cooking like that every day. But they didn't work outside the home.
Sure.
Then when women started to enter the workforce in large numbers in the 60s and 70s, at the same time, you had the rise of all these convenient foods, the TV dinners, the boxed cake mixes and things like that, with the idea that women didn't have as much time to spend in the kitchen. But if you're living on a food stamp budget, you have to make a choice. You can either buy the very cheap convenience food, which has kind of questionable nutritional value, a lot of fat, a lot of salt, not a lot of protein, not a lot of, you know, no fruits and vegetables to speak of. Or you spend the time to make and cook food the way my grandmother did.
Kids' lives are crazy busy right now. Yours are 11 and 13 at Highlands, probably doing the typical Highlands thing. What are they up to, and how did this project affect their lives?
My youngest has made the sixth grade volleyball team. The oldest is on the junior varsity Highlands tennis team, and they both have music and, you know, the usual kids' activities.
Yeah, so I mean, those days are, kids' lives are busy too now. And
oh, yes.
I'm sure they're going to go on the same path that a lot of Highlands kids do, which is lots of AP and lots of classes like that, and with volleyball and tennis and all that kind of stuff. That's a lot to do for the Hera household.
It's a lot of running.
Yeah.
Planning and the food prep is probably the part that's been the most surprising, is the time commitment involved to eat a healthy diet.
You ever find yourself going hungry? Are the kids ever complaining about that?
The only thing they complain about is not having enough junk food, but that's every kid, so I'm not worried about that. But no, we aren't going hungry at all.
Yeah.
No. Now, we do not have in the budget to buy all organic produce, hormone-free dairy, hormone-free meat. Some of those things that the government and the research types keep telling us is what we where we should be going, you know. But there's just not enough money in the budget for that.
So you are still going to carry this on for another 6 months. What are your findings so far in the study?
I think the findings are that if you don't live in a food desert, and if you have reliable transportation, and you're willing to put in the time in the kitchen, you can eat a healthy diet on food stamps. But it's not as easy as some people might lead you to believe.
Are you getting those questions that sometimes you're thinking, you know, $650 is plenty?
I get two types of questions. I get the people that are kind of snarky, because they think everybody on food stamps is lazy and a lazy bum that doesn't work.
Sure.
Which is not true at all, but you get those comments. But most of the questions are really about, well, how are you making this work? Most of the questions I've gotten have been very thoughtful. And so I've been real pleased by that.
Have those questions helped you form some opinions or new ways, new avenues of where your research is going on this project?
Yes, I think one of the things I've been surprised is how many people live in rural areas who have talked about living in food deserts, because we typically talk about that strictly from an urban area.
Sure.
And for those folks, there's no public transportation to help either. There's no tank bus, for example.
Where are you talking about specifically in these rural places in northern Kentucky?
Right. You know, if you live out, you know, past Hebron, for example, it's a long ways to get to the nearest Kroger. Places like that. I've been surprised how many rural people have sent me emails and left me voicemail messages about that.
How often you go into the grocery store now?
Oh, I go 2 or 3 times a week, but I've always done that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like to plan my meals out too far in advance.
Overall, not necessarily speaking about the economist, Janet Hera, are you learning about a lot about food stamps personally, your kids, your husband?
One of the things I told my husband, I was like, well, gee, it's kind of nice. We're spending $200 to $300 less a month than we were. So that's kind of nice. So I think we learn a lot for ourselves just in making our budget work better.
Where can we read more about this study? And are you going to publish it once it's complete?
Yes, yeah, so we have it. The CN has a bi-monthly newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be publishing updates on it in the newsletter every month or every other month.
Well, we'll be sure to check back and post the updates on FortThomasMatters.com. But while we've got you, I want to check on some other economic factors that are affecting the region. Regionalism is always a word that gets brought up every 4 years, particularly in the judge executive races in Northern Kentucky, more so probably in Campbell County, meaning that Kenton, Campbell, and Boone are stronger together when you form a coalition versus Campbell looking out for its best interest, Kenton looking out for its best interest, or Boone looking out for its best interest. With all that in mind, where do you come down on regionalism? Is it a good thing economically to have a strong three-county bond, or is it better for individual counties to kind of do their own thing?
Are you talking about regionalism, or are you talking about consolidation?
Yeah, it's a good point.
Because they're two very different things.
Sure.
One is talking about consolidating political power and election representation into one larger unit, which is what they've done in Louisville metro area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody is actively talking about that right now. What we're talking about instead is looking at doing shared services. Can we get a better deal for our taxpayers if we all do EMS together as opposed to everyone having their own separate 911 system?
Sure.
That's a very different question than consolidation. So I think it's really important to make sure that everybody understands the difference between the two and which one we're really talking
about. Yeah, I think maybe consolidation of services is down the road. By all means, I think the way that Judge Pendry and Moore and Nachman now are trending in a way that they're trying to show that the three-county power pact, if that's what you want to call it, is going to benefit the region more so. I don't think we're at a pitch yet where you can say, yes, let's go ahead and consolidate our governmental power like a Louisville Metro. And I think the thinking behind that is that if you can do that down the road, you're going to get more clout in Frankfurt, because right now when you've got separated services and separated governments, we've seen in Northern Kentucky especially that we're getting kind of looked over in Frankfurt as far as tax dollars, economic drivers, economic incentives, those types of things.
Does it save money? Is it more efficient? Does it provide better quality of services? If you can meet those three criteria, why wouldn't you do it?
How often do you meet with elected officials in Campbell County, and are they heeding your advice on economic direction and policy for the county and for the region in general? What about on your food stamp project that you're doing now?
Not on this topic.
On many topics, though?
I very rarely offer opinion on policy. My job as a researcher is to give people the facts and figures and let them take that and figure out what that means for any individual policy decision that's being made.
Lots of factors, indicators, obviously, but how do you feel like Northern Kentucky is doing economically right now?
Well, it depends on what you want to... Are we doing, overall the country is not growing very fast, and as a consequence, we are not either. But if you compare Northern Kentucky with other regions that we might be competing with, we're doing pretty well. So it kind of depends on how you ask the question.
One term that I hear quite frequently when I talk to people, stakeholders in the region, is they will talk about out towards Hebron and the airport, all the new businesses coming in with the job growth. They're calling it the Silicon Valley of logistics. Right here in Northern Kentucky, there's got to be a significant trickle down to that.
We have three large economic drivers in Northern Kentucky. We have the airport complex, we have Northern Kentucky University, and we have the St. Elizabeth Healthcare System. Those are our big three economic drivers, all of which are doing okay right now. They all have challenges. When we're talking about how overall Northern Kentucky is doing, we're doing pretty well on job growth. Actually doing better than most of our competitors. What we're not keeping up with is wage growth. The average annual wage per job is not as high, it's not growing as fast as some of our competitor regions. And that's just a matter of the mix of jobs that we're attracting.
So what can we do better? What advice would you give our three economic drivers in Northern Kentucky to help, I guess, bring that wage growth up on par with our job growth here in the region?
Well, I think part of it is understanding that you want your economy to be very diversified. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. So while we definitely want to leverage our competitive advantages in logistics and try to grow as much as we can out of the airport complex, because that's good for the region, we also don't want to lose sight that we have other industries. We want to make sure that we continue to service those industries and make sure they are doing well as well also.
This might be a silly question, but who are our competitors?
It depends on who you ask, but we tend to look at places like Columbus, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Nashville, other communities, this relatively similar size to the Cincinnati metro area.
this is going to be tough, but I want to try to get through this kind of quickly. Went through on your LinkedIn profile and you featured four different projects that you had worked on pretty recently. So I want to touch on some of the main takeaways or the thesis statements from what you took from those studies. The first one is the 2020 jobs outlook for the region. What were some of the main takeaways that you took from that study?
Well, a couple things. First of all, we're in the process of updating that. We're going to be releasing new forecasts through 2024 here in the next few months. But the big takeaways, I think, are if you want to make above average wages, which in that time was $35,000 a year, it is going to require some kind of post-secondary degree, an associate's or a bachelor's degree. The days of being able to make above minimum or above, you know, a median wage of about $35,000 a year, you're not going to make it unless you have a college education.
You see a lot of trade schools opening up, you know, talking about how to train to do things with your hands, how to manufacture, how to actually build. And there's some, you know, really decent wages out there for people that know how to do things. And it seems like our society anymore, we don't know how to do. We don't know how to make. But obviously those skills and those degrees for those trades are out there. They're needed and they're paying really well. So are you counting those in the post-secondary education?
Sure. When you're talking about post-secondary education, I mean, if you're going to get your become a licensed electrician,
sure,
you're going to make good money, but that's going to take some training and education beyond high school. And it's true, most of the construction trades, there's the folks that have licenses, that have specialized training, they make pretty good money. The day laborer without a high school education is probably not making much.
One study that I know that Fort Thomas in particular is really, really interested in is how NKU students spend their money. A lot of businesses on the south side of town particularly are, it's almost like a pot of gold. How do you get there? How do you get them to come to Fort Thomas to spend their dollars? And I think if there's a business that can, you know, uncover that secret formula or that secret sauce, there's a lot to that. What were some of the takeaways from that study? I mean, how much were NKU students spending outside of, you know, university typical costs?
We tend to forget how much money the students spend, not just on campus, but off campus. And what that would mean for Northern Kentucky if those students went elsewhere and spent that money. Because they're spending $250 million a year off campus.
You're a Fort Thomas resident.
Yes.
Like those businesses have always, you know, coveted the NKU student. How do you get them there? What advice would you give to our economic directors or our businesses on those side? How do you get NKU students to come into Fort Thomas?
Well, that I'm not sure I can answer, but I can tell you one thing that is beneficial for Fort Thomas being so close to NKU is if you go down the list of people, of employees at NKU that live in Fort Thomas and support the economy through home ownership.
Sure.
It's a long list.
Sure. Well, we are a bedroom community. We are not a economic driver in a sense that we're going to be providing the region a lot of jobs, except, of course, for our sponsor, Omega Processing Solutions. And I don't think really that if you would poll elected officials, I don't think that's what they want. I don't think the residents want that as well. But at the same time, I do feel like there are enough services that, you know, provide for people on a day-to-day basis in Fort Thomas. And the entertainment is getting better. But if you could figure out how to unlock that NKU student to Fort Thomas business concept, I think that would make things really, really interesting for Fort Thomas.
Right. And I think I think this is very evident when you go down
the Central Business,
District. That most of the services here are designed for the people that live here.
Sure.
And it is going to be a tough sell to get college students to come from NKU into Fort Thomas for services.
So I guess like the thing I would do if I were in economics or development of some sort would be to try to, you know, get some staples or some anchors in the city that would make the destination or the trip to Fort Thomas, which is typically not an easy place to get to, just to make that trip worthwhile. But you know, it's always been a challenge, and I don't know. We'll see.
It's a tough sell. Yeah.
So Janet Hara, where can people connect with you or find more information about SEAD?
On our homepage on the NKU website, which is sead.nku.edu.
And if people want to come over for hamburgers at lunch and then chicken and rice tonight, they can do that, right?
We'll be serving, yes.
Okay, all right.
Well, Janet Hara, thanks so much for being on Fort Thomas Matters Radio. You can catch all of our archives on fortthomasmatters.podbean.com or Fort Thomas Matters or wherever you listen to your podcast. Particularly iTunes. If you have enjoyed our conversation today in this podcast, one thing that you can really do to help us is to rate us on iTunes. It helps. Also, let our sponsor, Omega Processing Solutions, located on Alexandria Pike in Fort Thomas, let them know that you appreciate them sponsoring our podcast. Nobody else does this type of coverage on a podcast on a day-to-day basis like we do, and we can't do it without them. So thank you so much to Omega Processing Solutions. Please rate us on iTunes. And especially if you're a small business owner, go ahead and give your business, your credit card processing solutions business to Omega Processing Solutions. Nobody does it better. They're a leader in their industry and in our region.